Hey, I'm Janet French, and this is the Press Gallery. Before we get to today's show, just a reminder to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, or wherever you listen. Leave us a rating and a review, and it would really help us out. Enjoy this week's episode. Hello, and welcome to the Press Gallery, the Edmonton Journal's Alberta Politics podcast. It's Friday, November 29th, 2019, and this is episode 300. Woo!
Is this the This Is Sparta episode?
Oh, wait, yeah.
Is there some crazy war movie?
I was wondering why Keith was stripped down to the loincloth.
No, it's just how I dress on Fridays. What are you talking about?
Loincloth Friday, yeah.
Yeah.
Casual Friday.
Exactly.
Boy, Purple Shirt Thursday has gone really out of control.
Yeah.
Let's try that again. This is episode 300, the Nice Cool Freeze edition. I'll explain that in a minute. I'm your host, Janet French. With me today in studio are the Daves that I know. Some of them. Keith, sorry, you have to leave.
That's fine. I still get a cupcake, right?
Of course. David Staples is in front of me. Hello, how are you?
Hey, Janet, did you make those cupcakes?
Of course I did.
That's really sweet. Those would look good.
Oh, thanks. Well, make sure you eat one. Oh, no, wait. You can't eat like dairy and stuff, right? Okay,
well,
sorry.
I can and I can't. It's right. A long story.
Long story. The Jordan Peterson diet. Got it.
No, it's the Roundup they spray on the wheat in harvest, but I don't want to get into it because it's a bit of a – I'm not sure it's true.
I don't believe that topic is on today's episode. Next to him, another Dave I know, our managing editor, Dave Breckenridge.
I'll eat David Staples' cupcake
because yeah,
I don't
do
care
that.
What I put in my
yeah.
mouth.
Sweet. Give me all the Roundup. Yikes. Extra Roundup on Dave's cupcake. Please, Monsanto, don't listen to this podcast. And next to him is Keith Gerine, our legislature columnist. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I will eat a cupcake because, no shame whatsoever. I had a questionable leftover chicken sandwich for breakfast this morning.
So,
yeah.
That sounds cupcake promising.
Will be no problem.
Hashtag party like a journalist.
Exactly.
Yes, totally.
Hashtag Keith's glamorous life.
Loincloths and questionable chicken sandwiches.
I'd watch that reality show. Yeah. All right.
Oh, the visuals. I am so sorry, listeners. Anyway, as the temperature plummets, the UCP government continues to take some heat over the fallout of the firing of their election commissioner, Lorne Gibson. Maybe a little bit less cool this week were a couple of political moves by the NDP that invited a little bit of head scratching and worse. But first, Frozen is not just for kids in movie theaters. The government is putting a freeze on new photo radar equipment and locations in Alberta. So there was, you may recall, under the previous NDP government, there was a lengthy photo radar study that was commissioned. And man, we were asking about that thing every week and every month. Have you guys done the photo radar study yet? How about now? Finally, they came out and said, we're not entirely sure that photo radar is improving safety or saving lives. So then the question, once we had a new government, was, well, what are they going to do with this 170-page report and this very contentious issue? So earlier this week, Transportation Minister Rick McIver said, even though we have this big report, we feel like the data from different municipalities isn't comparable enough to tell whether or not this is just a cash cow or whether it's saving lives. And so what they want all the municipalities to do, these 27 that do use photo radar, is to collect data. They're going to talk about what they're going to collect, and then they're all going to be asked to collect it in the same way so that they can get a apples-to-apples provincial picture over whether photo radar does improve safety. And he's also asking, of course, for those municipalities' input. Now, this is in contrast with what the NDP was saying when they were on their way out of government, which is that they plan to put the cash cow down humanely. And they were going to give cities 1 year to prove that this, in fact, was a safety measure and not a money-raising measure. And the deadline to try and provide that proof was going to be in March. So now I guess that deadline is maybe not – does not exist anymore? It's a little unclear. Anyway – I believe that David Staples has some thoughts about photo radar. What were you hoping to hear from the government on Tuesday?
A little bit sterner rhetoric. I mean, I followed this debate long enough now. It's been, I wrote my first column on it 6 years ago. That's when they changed the threshold, when they started to give people photo radar tickets for lower level speeding. They moved it from 15K, which it had been forever, to 10K. And that's when you saw this huge increase in photo radar revenue in Edmonton from about $15 million a year, where there was no one really complaining about photo radar, to $50 million a year, where a bipartisan consensus developed that this was a cash cow. It's always interesting in Alberta politics when both sides of the aisle are saying the same thing because it's so rare. This was one of those issues where that happened. Over time, everyone got enough tickets that people were fed up. So you had not only Brian Mason using cash cow rhetoric, you had Jason Kenney using cash cow rhetoric, so both sides were using it. The interesting thing in McIver's press conference to me is that he wasn't using the cash cow. He was saying, well, some people are saying that, and this is a safety issue.
And then when people asked him, what do you think of these? This, he's like, well, my constituents tell me they think, blah. Like he was kind of deflecting his own opinion.
He was, and he brought up the safety argument. So when you hear the safety argument, and I've heard it enough over the 6 years of this debate, you know nothing's going to change because that's the argument, of course, that stops anything from happening because safety is super important. The only problem with the safety argument is when you look at Edmonton compared to other cities our same size that don't have photo radar like Ottawa, there's almost no difference in traffic accidents and traffic fatalities. So we have $50 million in fines essentially that aren't improving safety much compared to cities where they don't have photo radar at all. Nonetheless, because it's so much money, it's $220 million revenue across the province every single year.
And that was 2 years ago, so how much is it now?
It's probably similar, but I just don't see – I think the trend for governments in Canada is Edmonton isn't going to be the outlier. We're photo radar up the yin-yang way more than anybody else. I don't think we're going to be the outlier. I think cities like Toronto and all these other cities are going to see all that money and they're – across Canada, they're going to move as aggressively as they can towards more photo radar. So we're going to actually become more of the norm. And I don't think anything's going to change here in Alberta.
I was wondering about that because I remember in the budget, there was talk that the province may take a larger cut of fine revenues. I would assume that would include photo radar.
I was getting to that, but go on.
So I'm wondering if they've dialed down their rhetoric a bit because they're looking at photo radar as an opportunity to bring in more revenue to provincial coffers. I also wonder whether getting rid of this March 2020 deadline that Brian Mason had and pushing things down the road allows them later in their mandate to get a political win out of it. Because we know with the NDP, that report was done a few months before it was released, and they released it as close to the election as I think they possibly could after being nagged by the media for months about it.
Over and over.
Because it is photo radar is an easy win. If you come out strong against photo radar, you'll get a lot of people say, yeah, I'm with you on that. That they don't like it. They feel it's a cash cow. They feel, as David says, there's not a great deal of evidence that Edmonton is any safer a city than jurisdictions where they don't have it. And if you can't prove that it makes our roads safer, all it becomes is a revenue generation tool. And is that like, I get the argument that says, well, if you don't want a photo radar ticket, don't speed. I understand that, right? Like we set rules and we say people shouldn't speed. But if the goal, as many people say, is safety, there are other ways to get people to slow down. Man traffic enforcement with stiffer fines and demerits, and even those flashing solar powered signs that tells you how fast you're going and what the speed limit is, those will get you to slow down as well.
And
just as well as photo radar. So the idea that, you know, the safety argument flies out the window. And the question is, do we want a revenue generation tool to penalize people who are speeding? Yes or no. And the people who are in favor of photo radar need to come out and say that.
It has been kind of interesting over the past year to see the NDP and the Conservatives trying to kind of outdo each other in terms of rhetoric. I'm tougher on photo radar. No, I'm tougher on photo radar. When Brian Mason came out with his report back in the spring, that was seemed quite tough and seemed like it was going after municipalities quite hard and imposing a pretty hard standard on them. We went to Jason Kenney that same day or the day after, and he says, oh, I'm going to get even tougher. I'm going to be even bigger on this. And then you're right, David Stables, to see Brian, there's two Daves in here. I have to be specific. to see the new transportation minister, Rick McIver's press conference, he really dialed it back. That was not what I was expecting from that press conference at all. And I think Dave Breckenridge is right that there is a, I think the fundamental principle here that we do need to use this tool for safety, not to to penalize people, not to to as a revenue collection, although I see the temptation of it. I do wonder about one thing, though, and that is that this provincial budget is cutting municipalities pretty hard. We've already heard in Calgary, for example, that they are going to have to reduce police officers. That may happen in Edmonton. Does that mean fewer police on the streets enforcing traffic? And in that case, does PhotoRadar become a potentially more useful tool if it's used in the right place? But we have to find out where those most effective places are, if there are any. And so I don't actually hate what the government is doing here. I think a better study, because the last study that the NDP did, I didn't think was adequate. So if we can actually get a better study here, get better data, and determine once and for all whether this is actually having any effect on traffic safety or not, that I think is actually a good thing.
And the traffic safety data in the, it was Myers Norris Penney that did that previous study under the NDP government, it just came up with correlations. So, I mean, correlation is not causation, right? They're saying, well, the locations of PhotoRadar were associated with a 1-point-something decline in fatalities. But if there's only 27 municipalities and there's only X number of PhotoRadar sites, is that a large enough sample size to be statistically significant? Sorry, I'm nerding out on this. Moving on. So,
well, I think they just compared it to – I think the focus of their study was to compare cities that had it with those that don't. And they weren't trying to look so much at specific sites, but no, but I could be wrong. But I think the study, I mean, we're not, when you got into it, there was a lot of math real quick. And I think it was, most of us are not qualified. I'm not qualified to talk on how scientifically valid that study was, but it sounded like just the way they explained it, we're comparing cities with PhotoRadar to those without. That seemed like a reasonable way to go about it to me.
Mm-hmm. So as Dave Breckenridge mentioned, there also is a bill before the legislature right now that makes many changes to municipalities and municipal funding. And one of the things it does is it gives the provincial government a higher cut of fine revenue from municipalities. So before they used to take 27% of fine revenue from cities, and they said that the justification for that was that we can use it, we need that money because we administer the fine collection program. So we need it to cover our costs. Now they're going to up that to 40% if this bill passes. So of course the NDP opposition says, well, of course they're not going to put down the cash cow. Like they're getting more of the cash because, you know, while the government argues that it has the Alberta has a spending problem, some people would argue that Alberta has a revenue problem. So is it that they just can't give up any potential source of revenue that they might glean
here? I mean, it's a long-standing argument around the sales tax in Alberta, and you have conservative-leaning economists who feel that a sales tax is a better form of taxation, but the argument goes that then they have to turn around and lower your income tax. But no government in their right mind would turn around and lower income taxes because they like money. Like governments aren't keen to get rid of a source of income. The other thing I was just wondering, as we've been talking about this and the idea that the province is taking a bigger cut of fine revenue, is could delaying the removal or putting it off indefinitely of PhotoRadar in Alberta be kind of a trade-off for the cities? And the province comes and says, yeah, we're going to take 13 points more revenue.
Like an olive branch.
But we'll let you have PhotoRadar because that's good for us, but it also lets you keep money in your pocket. Could that be what's going on? I don't know if that's what's going on, but it kind of, the thought popped into my head as we were talking about the idea of the province taking a bigger share of fine revenue.
I don't know. Don Iveson seemed pretty skeptical about that. Don't you think?
If you're taking the profit, there's a huge incentive to keep those profits coming in. And I mean, the clearest evidence of this was when the police used to run the PhotoRadar in Edmonton till 2012. And the second the city took over, who gets the money, the revenues tripled. So, you know, was that all about safety or did they suddenly see a huge source of revenue? Because at the same time, they had just switched over their PhotoRadar process and there had been huge cost overruns, $50 million. The city had a huge black eye looking to a way to get out of that pickle financially and propaganda PR wise. So I think anytime the government is getting revenue, of course, they're going to be loath to give it up. And I think that could be a real motive for the Conservatives not to do anything on this.
Mm-hmm. Tangentially, why did the city of Edmonton lower the buffer from 15 kilometers an hour to 10? Because I've gotten...
get him started now.
I have been the unwitting recipient of a photo radar ticket in a school zone when I realized it was the wrong hours and I went 42 kilometers an hour because I was accelerating and the supercar was there.
You see, when they brought in photo radar in the 90s, the argument was, we're not going after just people who creep up over the speed limit. The idea is we want to go after the reckless speeders, the people who are really speeding. And I did a story on it at the time. A police officer said that, made it clear. We're setting the threshold at 15K over because we only want to get those reckless speeders. And there would be no debate in Alberta if they had not changed that, but they have changed it. And the argument is that every kilometer per hour over the speed limit leads to greater and more dangerous accidents.
Kills a child even more splatteringly.
Yeah, but it's not there's been studies done on this, and I think the 15K was defensible. Certainly 10K is definitely defensible. Anything below 10K over the speed limit is I think a real overreach. But I would, if they set it at 15K, this debate would be over. That would be the best move they could make.
I think Dave's right. The way that the city of Edmonton handled this when they changed the threshold for giving a ticket.
Secretly,
that was the big thing. They didn't tell anyone they were doing it. And all of a sudden, these thousands and thousands of more tickets came out. I think that has badly contributed to the public's disappointment with this particular tool and suspicion of it. And I think the city of Edmonton can maybe look to see why the government is now reviewing this with a little more of a keen sense of proving that this is actually a traffic safety tool, not just a revenue collection tool. I think the city of Edmonton needs to look in the mirror a bit on that one.
I'm going to move on to something a little less civic and a little more inside the dome-ish. Some interesting things happened on Tuesday in particular this week when it comes to the NDP opposition. Maybe it's just that the session is getting a bit long. It's been a grueling year with a provincial election. We've had two sittings already. We're at Bill 29 in about 7 months, 6 months. The legislature has been sitting into the night, so some of these people are working very long hours. So maybe they're getting a little off. I don't know. So one of the interesting things that happened this week was that on Tuesday, NDP culture critic Nicole Gehring accused the Ministry of Culture, Multiculturalism, and Status of Women of purchasing $35,608.77 in liquor from Prestige Liquor, which was noteworthy to them because the owner of Prestige Liquor is a UCP donor and was, I think, a Jason Kenney delegate or a supporter of Jason Kenney's during the 2017 UCP leadership race. And it turns out if that sounds indefensible, there was actually a good reason why they bought $35,000 worth of liquor. We'll get to that. Also on Tuesday, one of the NDP's most notoriously outspoken MLAs, Marlon Schmidt, he's my MLA, by the way. Hey, Marlon. He had to apologize for his remarks four times after saying things like calling the UCP the incel caucus and accused a UCP MLA of making light of a story he was telling about Indigenous slavery on sugar beet farms. And he said the agriculture and forestry minister stood up on his hind legs during the first day of the CN rail strike demanding back-to-work legislation. And when he withdrew his remarks, you can decide if this is apologetic or not. He said, "Yes, Mr. Speaker, I apologize and withdraw. The next time, I'll say that he stood on his front legs."
Jason Nixon is a bear-like and... Was he talking about Jason
Nixon?
No,
he's talking about Devin Dreeshen.
Oh, Devin Dreeshen. Yeah. Oh, I thought he was talking about the large...
No.
I'm gesticulating wildly here.
He is.
Jason
there
Nixon
are a lot
is a
of
tall
arms.
Man. Sorry, Devin Dreeshen does not look like an animal. I'm not saying that Jason Nixon
animals.
Looks like an animal.
Anyway.
This took an interesting
Marlon
turn.
Really did not... Where are we going? Marlon really did not like that farm safety legislation to repeal some of the Bill 6 changes. And also on Tuesday, Keith watched a public accounts committee meeting, which went quite off the rails. So let's maybe start there. Tell us what happened at this public accounts committee meeting in a way that's totally not bureaucratic.
Right.
Good luck.
So, okay. Yeah. So this relates to the firing of the election commissioner, Lauren Gibson, through Bill 22, and the NDP trying to do anything they can to kind of draw public attention to it. And so one of the things that they've tried to do is through the Public Accounts Committee. That is the only committee chaired by an NDP member, happens to be finance critic Shannon Phillips. And you may remember last week, one of the things she did is she said, I am not going to hold public accounts meetings anymore until we hear from the election commissioner, Lauren Gibson. And she called for an emergency agenda change to hear from him. Well, this turned out to be an empty threat because the UCP members on the Public Accounts Committee just ignored her request. Gibson was fired as of last Friday, so he couldn't appear before the committee. And the next committee meeting turned out to be Tuesday. So the NDP tried to essentially shut down the meeting in a very strange way. They made a point of privilege, the members there, to say that they had been kind of blocked in their duties, obstructed in their duties to hear from the commissioner. And Shannon Phillips, the chair, said, well, somebody's raised a point of privilege, so the proper procedure here is to just adjourn the meeting so that the privilege matter can be heard from or can be dealt with. Well, turns out she didn't exactly have her procedure correct. The clerk informed her, no, she had to put that motion to the floor. And the UCP, which holds a majority on that committee, said, no, we're not going to deal with the privilege motion. Now we're going to continue the meeting. So the NDP's strategy after that was to kind of waste time by making amendments and talking to the motion. And they wound up wasting about 2/3 of the meeting with repetitive motions and amendments. And the poor health officials from AHS and the health ministry who were sitting there and had taken time out of their schedule basically got no time to be interviewed or to talk about things going on in the health ministry. So whether the NDP actually made their point or not, I was a little skeptical. I think they came across as a bit more bumbling than they intended at this point.
Is this like, I don't know if it's a filibuster per se. It's maybe a little bit obstructive. Like how often do you see a filibuster-like thing happen at a legislative committee?
Yeah, it doesn't happen often. This was a new one for me. And honestly, the Public Accounts Committee is more for the opposition. That's their attempt or their chance to kind of attack and make points and ask questions of government ministries. And instead, they kind of ate into their own time. I just didn't quite understand what they were doing there.
Interesting. So the liquor, it turns out, back to the liquor. So Nicole Gehring brought up this point about the $35,000 worth of liquor in question period. And the look on Minister Leela here's face was just like, huh? What do you normally like? Ministers are prepped for issues that they might expect. This one, she just was like, I don't know what in hell you're talking about. And it turned out to be a purchase contract for a restaurant at the Royal Alberta Museum where they sell the liquor to patrons, like for resale, maybe for a profit even. And it turns out that the ministry had even used Prestige Liquor as a supplier during the last few months of the NDP government. Awkward.
This is one of those things. It was bound to happen at some point. The NDP, you know, people have talked about, and to be in a way that's trying to be critical of the government, of them trying to do too much to make everyone's head spin. But the opposition is as guilty of that as the government, as they've tried to churn out a new controversy every day and pile on. And sometimes you can't keep straight who's talking about what some days. And so it was bound to happen that they were going to hit a bad week or hit a dud. And the liquor one was the worst because, you know, as soon as you turn around and say, yeah, the museum was using this supplier last November when the NDP was in power, it's just egg all over their face. And then even on top of that, there were NDP supporters on social media this week who were saying, why does the museum need to spend that much on booze? It's just all school trips and stuff. It's like, well, no, facilities like that hold events. Like the Art Gallery of Alberta constantly has people coming through there for yoga and cocktails and little soirees,
weddings. Tell me more about weddings. Yoga and yeah. cocktails.
I don't know if they're together. One and the same, but yeah, like the cultural facilities like that host groups and host events all the time. And it was just hilarious to watch all these people who had dug in that this was another element of UCP corruption try to dig themselves out of their hole, but wound up digging themselves even further. It was kind of hilarious to watch.
It was also damaging, not just hilarious, because the NDP had been putting a lot of pressure and generating a lot of public attention on Bill 22. Not that any of their moves were effective at stopping the government, but I think they had raised considerable awareness. And when they threw this dud with the liquor out, it just allowed the UCP to change the channel. There we have Jason Kenney on Twitter taking a trip to Prestige Liquor with a nice box of holiday libations and saying, hey, just stop by this great liquor spot that I heard about today for the
totally
first time
random.
Ever.
Yeah. Totally random.
Yeah, they're open late. What great service here, right? And just totally mocking them, right? And a bit of a cheap political shot, but hey, they kind of deserved it. And it's, you know, it took away the attention from, I think, the bigger issues. And that, to me, was the NDP's problem with all of this stuff, is they need to focus on the priorities. They need to focus on the things that are actually making a dent in this government's popularity with its base. And boy, that did not help.
Yeah, we've talked last, or I've mentioned a couple times on this podcast about how the UCP has had a series of own goals. And it doesn't help them move their agenda forward. The same is true with the NDP. This just is kind of like Marlon Schmidt's outbursts don't do them any favors with centrist voters who may not be big fans of the UCP, but aren't necessarily UCP supporter, NDP supporters. I know not many Albertans pay attention to committees other than us nerds, but even, you know, derailing the committee that they control the majority of, it just doesn't, it's not a good look on a party that was up until the spring, the government. I don't understand what they're playing at or why they think that some of these things are going to win them any points.
You know, sometimes when a government agency like the Royal Alberta Museum buys liquor, it's just because they need liquor and there's no politics attached to it. And I think the NDP's problem here is that they're trying to politicize everything. Everything's political. Everything's political. People are tired of that. So this kind of gaffe really highlighted that. The NDP is strong when they're strong on the economy. Rachel Notley did some good things, you know, in terms of the setting oil patch policy right in the province. She should stick to that. She should be the same sensible voice of how we can develop a consensus in Canada about getting the oil patch going again. That's her strength. And when they start like this incel comment, like who says that? You know, aren't we supposed to leave people's
apparently
sexuality out of politics? This is really offensive to people that, you know, you bring up comments like this. This is just ridiculous. And someone on the left should know that as much as anyone, that this kind of thing is out of bounds. So when they start to stray into these areas, they get off their strength, which was becoming a real strength for Notley, standing up for Alberta's economy. I think they get into trouble with Albertans, and they'd be wise to think about that.
Yeah. In interesting times. Although I think, like, is it just oppositioning? You know, it sort of doesn't matter which party is in opposition in whatever province I've been in. They're always like, fire, yeah, brimstone, outrage. Shaking my fists around.
They are just doing their job. Yeah, they're doing their job. That's for sure. And that's part of it. And, you know, on the one big mistake that I think Kenney has made, I don't think anything of all these scandals that we've heard in the last year with Kenney, I don't think any of them have stuck at all, except for him. As Dave put it, the own goal of firing the election commissioner. I think anytime you're being investigated for something and then you fire the person investigating you, that starts to look bad to everybody on both sides of the aisle. That was a mistake by Kenney. They've got to fix it, frankly. And until they do, they have a problem there. So there has been one mistake outside of the economy. Like, people don't care in Alberta right now about anything except the economy. So the NDP trying to raise all these other issues, there's no uptake on it because people are really suffering. This is one, though, that I think is outside of that because it's just it's a very simple thing. You fired the guy investigating you. Everyone can understand that. It's really simple. And Kenny made a mistake there that he's got to fix.
Good segue, because that is, in fact, the next thing we are talking about. You just did my job for me. Thumbs up. So, you know, the government does still seem to be getting a chilly reception. Speaking of freezing. From their rapid move last week to dismiss Lauren Gibson. He, of course, levied hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of election finance violation fines against people who were involved with the 2017 UCP leadership race. But the question now, and the thing that that everybody's been grappling with this week is like, what does it mean now for the ongoing investigations? Who's actually in charge of these things? Is work happening on them? Is work happening with the same tenacity? Who's in charge around here? Do we name people who are involved? And the naming issue was what became apropos this week, I suppose. It turns out on Tuesday, and I still don't understand why this happened the way it did, Elections Alberta, before there was an election commissioner as of mid-2018, they used to do investigations into election financing violations. And so they had actually started some already before the election commissioner took over. And so suddenly when this responsibility reverted back to Elections Alberta this week, these three descriptions of different penalties suddenly appeared in a chart on their website from investigations that predated the commissioner. And the weird thing about them was that there were no names attached to them. So it was a description of the violations and the fines levied and where the case was at and a time scale. But there was no names, which was a deviation from the way that the election commissioner dealt with that issue. The election commissioner had a chart that would say the person's name or the company's name, the entity's name that committed the violation, then the amount of the fine or what kind of penalty was levied, and a brief description of what transpired to prompt this. And so that raised some questions. And the way we found out about this is because it got out that last week, Conservative organizer Alan Hallman, who managed Premier Jason Kenney's by-election campaign in Calgary Lougheed, he ended up in court appealing one of these fines. But we didn't know that from the Elections Alberta website because Alan Hallman was not named on the website. So we had this case out there of an alleged elections violation that had no record attached to it anywhere on the election commissioner or the Elections Alberta's website, which was pretty confounding, which raised the question, are we just not naming people who break the law anymore? And why? Why would we change that? Which, of course, prompted the NDP to allege that the Kenney government was now withholding the names of people facing penalties. That might have been a bit of a stretch because this is a decision that lies with Elections Alberta, which is an independent office of the legislature. And it turned out that was not quite right. What happened was because these investigations were already ongoing, Elections Alberta was using this old policy to decide. So there was much, much fretting, much ado about cover-ups and secrecy and conspiracy and all that good stuff that we see online. So yesterday, Elections Alberta came out and said, okay, we've reviewed this very, very quickly and we've decided we will, in fact, publish the names of the people who have committed election law violations and the details and any details that the election commissioner would have made public, we will also make public. And then they reissued this chart with the names installed, including Alan Hallman. How well did Elections Alberta handle this situation?
Well, I mean, they came to the right decision in the end. This is just an example. I know people, again, trying to raise the stench of conspiracy and cover up and all that sort of stuff. This is just further proof how opaque government can be and how their interpretations of FOIP law, Freedom of Information law, is not always in line with what the public may want in terms of transparency. And this is, you know, we saw this under Edmonton Police Service, under the previous Chief Rod Connect, who, it wasn't his decision, but the information that the police force said they were getting from their in-house counsel saying that, you know, to release names of homicide victims would violate privacy laws in some cases unless there was an investigative reason to release the name. But under the new chief, he's turned around and said, no, we want to be more transparent. But so that's what this Elections Alberta thing reminds me of, is that bureaucratic lawyers who have a very strict reading of freedom of information laws saying, don't do that, erring too much on the side of caution. And I think that when Lorne Gibson was appointed election commissioner, he had a different view of that.
It was a different time.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you know, they put names up on the election commissioner's website for people who were found in violation of election laws. But you couldn't get them for an interview. There were no details in, it was just names, kind of what a brief one sentence of what the offense was and the fine, but there
and
was
whether
no other
they
detail.
Paid it or not.
Yeah. So, I mean, baby steps here, people.
And actually, Elections Alberta, I think, has said they're even considering whether they should go further than the election commissioner. Were you about to say that, Keith?
Yeah, no, and I would encourage them to do that. I think one of the frustrations that we saw under Lauren Gibson is that while he did produce more information, it still wasn't a whole lot to put the pieces together. What we have learned about the UCP leadership mess has largely come from Lauren Gibson, but we still don't have a lot of the connecting pieces to understand what actually went on there. And that's because the election commissioner has taken the legislation to mean that he is subject to very strict non-disclosure rules. And I think the NDP is probably kicking themselves at this point that they didn't change the legislation when they had a chance to allow him to more openly discuss his cases or post more information. I don't think the UCP is going to have much interest in changing the legislation now, but perhaps the chief electoral officer will take a hard look at that and see if there is perhaps more that the public can know about a particular case, because there does seem to be an interest in that.
I wonder, though, if this is an impossible situation for Elections Alberta. I mean, they basically, Bill 22, which terminated the election commissioner and moved that office underneath Elections Alberta, was introduced on a Monday, passed by Thursday, and had royal assent by Friday. And so basically, Election Alberta had maybe 4 days' notice that they were, unless they had some sort of tip-off internally, that they were going to be taking over the function of another office.
I doubt it.
You doubt it. Okay.
Yeah, I doubt they were. Well, I mean, Lauren Gibson himself didn't know about the legislation until it was introduced. So I think it's unlikely that Glenn Ressler knew about the legislation before his predecessor. So, yeah, I mean, it is a difficult situation. They've been having to deal with this on the fly. They've suddenly got 5 new employees. They have to get caught up on all the cases. And they made a fairly quick decision here. Like, their review of deciding whether or not to post names, I think it took only about 24 hours, right? So there was a kind of a difficult 24-hour period there where there was some negative stories about how this was going to go. But then they came to the right decision pretty quickly, got some legal advice by the sounds of it, and came to a good conclusion. That only gets us so far, right? This is now, I think, being framed by a lot of people as saying, well, see, we told you that all these investigations would continue and nothing would change and there's no conspiracy here. Well, let's be clear. We've posted some names, but we still don't know how those investigations are going to go, whether the Glenn Ressler is going to hire a commissioner position, who that commissioner is going to be, and whether the investigations are actually going to proceed in the way that they have been in the past. That, I think, is still the big question, not necessarily whether we have names to see.
And part of that will be decided later today, or at least the beginning of that decision will happen later today. There is a meeting where all the independent legislative officers will go before a committee and present their budgets, including Glenn Ressler. Oh, the timing is amazing. Lauren Gibson was supposed to present today. Sorry, Lauren, you're out. But Ressler will go, and apparently Elections Alberta said yesterday he will be asking for the budget to continue to do both functions, to maintain all the investigation positions and the investigations, which is super interesting because one of the justifications for this whole drama is that it's going to save money. It's supposed to save money to have one office, not two offices doing this work. So if he's just asking for the same budget, where's the alleged $1 million savings over 5 years? Rhetorical question. I don't know.
Very good question.
Thanks. That's why they pay me.
I'm sure the NDP will be asking that as well.
I'm sure. I am very pumped about this meeting this afternoon. We'll see what happens. Anyway, for the interim, we have some things for you to read or consume for fun. David Staples, what do you have to recommend for our listeners to have a gander at this week?
Well, I'm a big podcast guy. It's really great when you're doing the dishes and, you know, cleaning the floors, shoveling the walks. you can multitask, listen to
feed
your head. And so my favorite podcast over time has always been.
Is this one?
It's been the Press Gallery. And number two on the list is Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Fantastic history buff. And he's been doing a fantastic series on Japan and the Second World War leading up to the Second World War. How the absolutely fanatical ideology that animated Japan in that war, took over that country. And he's now on part three. It's called Supernova in the East. Part three just came out. So there's probably like 15 hours you can listen to.
How many dishes do you have? That's one of the things that keeps me away from Dan Carlin is the
He has like five kids.
I walk to work sometimes when I do come to the office. And yeah, no, I live, there's, you know, I can easily find a couple hours a day to, of housework to listen to podcasts too.
Dave Breckenridge, what do you have for us?
I have something that is much, much shorter than an episode of Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. It's not a podcast, though it is something to listen to. I've been spending a lot of time recently listening to a lot more music than I have. I've kind of taken a bit of a podcasting break. I have a lot of stuff in my queue on my podcast app to listen to, but I'm going to recommend the new album by Beck. It's called Hyperspace. 25 years into his career, he's teamed up with producer Pharrell Williams for the first time. And it is just, you know, as Variety says, it's joyfully introspective, minimalistic, but sophisticated, contagiously melodic, straight ahead, analog synth pop record. Wow. It's a delight to listen to it, you know, for someone who's 25 years into his career and he's changed his sound up numerous times. He sounds really fresh, really. It's about 32, 35 minute long album.
Yeah, short.
It's a great listen. Huh. I highly recommend it.
I read a lot of good things this week, but my favorite was actually a series of stories from the Detroit Free Press who have done a great job covering this issue. Has anyone ever heard of the University of Farmington in Michigan?
Of course. Who hasn't?
Yeah, I mean that Ivy League institution. It's fake. It's not real. It doesn't exist. And unbelievably, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency set up this fake university to lure people, immigrants, to the U.S. so they could bust them for immigration crimes. I'm speechless. Anyway, you should read the latest story. There have been almost 250 students at this fake university now arrested for, anyway, it's a thing. And it's a fascinating technique used by the U.S. government. Keith.
I'm going to go a little out of left field with this one. It's a opinion piece in Scientific American titled "Scientists Should Stop Naming Species After Awful People." And so there is this trend.
Good luck with that.
I know that plants, insects, newly discovered species, sometimes scientists like to find a characteristic about it and then name it after somebody from history. And some of these folks from history are not particularly good. There's some, you know, bugs and plants that are named after people that committed atrocities against Native Americans, a Confederate general that was, you know, a pretty profound defender of slavery. There's even a beetle named after Adolf Hitler, which has apparently become a bit of a collector's item among neo-Nazis and has not been good for that beetle's survival. So, yeah, it's a bit strange, right? Now, that goes back a ways. But anyway, not a trend that we should probably be continuing here. But it is an interesting look at how these species are actually named and the process they use.
That's really going to change the periodic table.
It is.
Yeah.
Huh. They're doing it to be funny? The scientists, they think it's a joke? Is that
It may be funny, but I think they actually look at a characteristic of that bug or plant and say, oh, that's like this historical figure in one respect. And so it's, but kind of ignoring the moral implications of it.
It's not enough to just publish your stuff in a peer-reviewed journal anymore. You got to go for maximum exposure by making a controversial link. I don't know.
That is definitely part of it.
Is it? Yes. Okay, interesting. Well, that is all the time we have for today. If you've got any feedback, you can email me at jfrench@postmedia.com or tweet at me at jantafrench on Twitter. Join us next week for another episode of The Press Gallery.